exactly how my songs related to literature. I wanted to reflect on it and see where the connection was. I'm going to try to articulate that to you, and most likely it will go in a roundabout way. But I hope what I say will be worthwhile and purposeful. If I was to go back to the dawning of it all, I guess I'd have to start with Buddy Holly. Buddy died when I was about 18 and he was 22. From the moment I first heard him, I felt akin. I felt related, like he was an older brother. I even thought I resembled him. Buddy played the music that I loved, the music I grew up on, country western, rock and roll, and rhythm and blues. Three separate strands of music that he intertwined and infused into one genre, one brand. And Buddy wrote songs, songs that had beautiful melodies and imaginative verses. And he sang great. He sang in more than a few voices. He was the archetype, everything I wasn't and wanted to be. I saw him only but once, and that was a few days before he was gone. I had to travel 100 miles to get to see him play, and I wasn't disappointed. He was powerful and electrifying, and had a commanding presence. I was only 6 feet away. He was mesmerizing. I watched his face, his hands, the way he tapped his foot, his big black glasses, the eyes behind the glasses, the way he held his guitar, the way he stood, his neat suit, everything about him. He looked older than 22. Something about him seemed permanent, and he filled me with conviction. Then out of the blue, the most uncanny thing happened. He looked me right straight dead in the eye, and he transmitted something, something I didn't know what, and it gave me the chills. I think it was a day or two after that that his plane went down, and somebody I'd never seen before, handed me a Leadbelly record with the song Cotton Fields on it. And that record changed my life right then and there, transported me into a world I'd never known. It was like an explosion went off, like I'd been walking in darkness, and all of a sudden the darkness was illuminated. It was like somebody laid hands on me. I must have played that record 100 times. It was on a label I'd never heard of, with a booklet inside, with advertisements for other artists on the label. Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, the New Lost City Ramblers, Gene Ritchie, string bands. I'd never heard any of them. But I reckon if they were on this label with Leadbelly, they had to be good, so I needed to hear them. I wanted to know all about it and play that kind of music. I still had that feeling for the music I'd grown up with, but for right now, I forgot about it. Didn't even think about it. For the time being, it was long gone. I hadn't left home yet, but I couldn't wait to. I wanted to learn this music and meet the people who played it. Eventually, I did leave, and I did learn to play those songs. They were different than the radio songs that I'd been listening to all along. They were more vibrant and truthful to life. With radio songs, a performer might get a hit with a roll of the dice or a fall of the cards, but that didn't matter in the folk world. Everything was a hit. All you had to do was be well-versed and be able to play the melody. Some of these songs were easy, some not. I had a natural feeling for the ancient ballads and country blues, but everything else I had to learn from scratch, and I was playing for small crowds, sometimes no more than 4 or 5 people in a room or on a street corner. You had to have a wide repertoire, and you had to know what to play and when. Some songs were intimate, some you had to shout to be heard. By listening to all the early folk artists and singing the songs yourself, you pick up the vernacular, you internalize it. You sing it in the ragtime blues, work songs, Georgia Sea Shanties, the Appalachian ballads and cowboy songs. You hear all the finer points and you learn the details. You know what it's all about, taking a pistol out, putting it back in your pocket, whipping your way through traffic, talking in the dark. You know that Steiger Lee was a bad man and that Frankie was a good girl. You know that Washington is a bourgeois town, and you heard the deep-pitched voice of John the Revelator, and you saw the Titanic sink in a boggy creek, and you're pals with the wild Irish Rover and the wild Colonial Boy. You heard the muffled drums and the fifes that played lully. You've seen the lusty Lord Donald stick a knife in his wife, and a lot of your comrades have been wrapped in white linen. I had all the vernacular down. I knew the rhetoric. None of it went over my head. the devices, the techniques, the secrets, the mysteries, and I knew all the deserted roads that it traveled on too. I could make it all connect and move with the current of the day. When I started writing my own songs, the folk lingo was the only vocabulary that I knew, and I used it. But I had something else as well. I had principles and sensibilities and an informed view of the world, and I had had that for a while. Learned it all in grammar school, Don Quixote, Ivanhoe, Robinson Crusoe, Gulliver's Travels, Tale of Two Cities, all the rest. Typical grammar school reading that gave you a way of looking at life, an understanding of human nature, and a standard to measure things by. I took all that with me when I started composing lyrics, and the themes from those books worked their way into many of my songs, either knowingly or unintentionally. I wanted to write songs unlike anything anybody ever heard, and these themes were fundamental. Specific books that have stuck with me ever since I read them way back in grammar school. I want to tell you about three of them. Moby Dick, All Quiet on the Western Front, and The Odyssey. Moby Dick is a fascinating book. A book that's filled with scenes of high drama and dramatic dialogue. The book makes demands on you. The plot is straightforward. The mysterious Captain Ahab, captain of a ship called the Pequod, an egomaniac with a peg leg, pursuing his nemesis, the great white whale Moby Dick, who took his leg. And he pursues him all the way from the Atlantic, around the tip of Africa, and into the Indian Ocean. He pursues the whale around both sides of the earth. It's an abstract goal, nothing concrete or definite. He calls Moby the Emperor, sees him as the embodiment of evil. Ahab's got a wife and child back in Nantucket that he reminisces about now and again. You can anticipate what will happen. The ship's crew is made up of men of different races, and any one of them who sights the whale will be given the reward of a gold coin. A lot of zodiac symbols, religious allegory, stereotypes. Ahab encounters other whaling vessels, presses the captain for details about Moby. Have they seen him? There's a crazy prophet, Gabriel, on one of the vessels, and he predicts Ahab's doom. Says Moby is the incarnate of a Shaker god, and that any dealings with him will lead to disaster. He says that to Captain Ahab. Another ship's captain, Captain Boomer, he lost an arm to Moby, but he tolerates that, and he's happy to have survived. He can't accept Ahab's lust for vengeance. This book tells how different men react in different ways to the same experience. A lot of Old Testament biblical allegory. Gabriel, Rachel, Jeroboam, Bildad, Elijah. Pagan names as well. Tashtego, Flask, Dagu, Fleece, Stubbuck, Stub, Martha's Vineyard. The pagans are idol worshippers. Some worship little wax figures, some wooden figures. Some worship fire. The Pequod is the name of an Indian tribe. Moby Dick is a seafaring tale. One of the men, the narrator, says, "Call me Ishmael." Somebody asks him where he's from. He says, "It's not down on any map. True places never are." Stubb gives no significance to anything. Says everything is predestined. Ishmael's been on a sailing ship his entire life. Calls the sailing ships his Harvard and Yale. He keeps his distance from people. A typhoon hits the Pequod. Captain Ahab thinks it's a good omen. Stubbuck thinks it's a bad omen. Considers killing Ahab. As soon as the storm ends, a crew member falls from the ship's mast and drowns, foreshadowing what's to come. A Quaker pacifist priest, who is actually a bloodthirsty businessman, tells Flask, "Some men who receive injuries are led to God. Others are led to bitterness." Everything is mixed in. All the myths, the Judeo-Christian Bible, Hindu myths, British legends, St. George, Perseus, Hercules, they're all whalers. Greek mythology, the gory business of cutting up a whale. Lots of facts in this book. Geographical knowledge, whale oil, good for coronation of royalty. The noble families in the whaling industry. Whale oil is used to anoint the kings. History of the whale, phrenology, classical philosophy, pseudo-scientific theories, justification for discrimination, everything thrown in, and none of it hardly rational. Highbrow, lowbrow, chasing illusion, chasing death. The great white whale, white as a polar bear, white as a white man, the emperor, the nemesis, the embodiment of evil. The demented captain who actually lost his leg years ago, trying to attack Moby with a knife. We see only the surface of things. We can interpret what lies below any way we see fit. Crewmen walk around on deck listening for mermaids, and sharks and vultures follow the ship, reading skulls and faces like you read a book. Here's a face, I put it in front of you. Read it if you can. Testigo says that he died and was reborn. His extra days are a gift. He wasn't saved by Christ, though. He says he was saved by a fellow man, and a non-Christian at that. He parodies the resurrection. When Starbuck tells Ahab that he should let bygones be bygones, the angry captain snaps back. Speak not to me, a blasphemy man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. Ahab, too, is a poet of eloquence. He says, the path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails, whereon my soul is grooved to run. For these lines, all visible objects are but pasteboard masks, quotable poetic phrases that can't be beat. Finally, Ahab spots Moby, and the harpoons come out. Boats are lowered. Ahab's harpoon has been baptized in blood. Moby attacks Ahab's boat and destroys it. Next day, he sights Moby again. Boats are lowered again. Moby attacks Ahab's boat again. On a third day, another boat goes in. More religious allegory. He has risen. Moby attacks one more time, ramming the Pequod and sinking it. Ahab gets tangled up in the harpoon lines and is thrown out of his boat into a watery grave. Ishmael survives. He's in the sea floating on a coffin. And that's about it. That's the whole story. That theme and all that it implies would work its way into more than a few of my songs. All Quiet on the Western Front was another book that did. All Quiet on the Western Front is a horror story. This is a book where you lose your childhood, your faith in a meaningful world, and your concern for individuals. You're stuck in a nightmare, sucked up into a mysterious whirlpool of death and pain. You're defending yourself from elimination. You're being wiped off the face of the map. Once upon a time, you were an innocent youth with big dreams about being a concert pianist. Once you loved life and the world, and now you're shooting it to pieces. Day after day, the hornets bite you and worms lap your blood. You're a cornered animal. You don't fit anywhere. The falling rain is monotonous. There's endless assaults, poison gas, nerve gas, morphine, burning streams of gasoline, scavenging and scabbing for food, influenza, typhus, dysentery. Life is breaking down all around you and the shells are whistling. This is the lower region of hell. Mud, barbed wire, rat-filled trenches, rats eating the intestines of dead men. Trenches filled with filth, excrement. Someone shouts, "Hey, you there, stand and fight." Who knows how long this mess will go on? Warfare has no limits. You're being annihilated, and that leg of yours is bleeding too much. You killed a man yesterday, and you spoke to his corpse. You told him after this is over, you'll spend the rest of your life looking after his family. Who's profiting here? The leaders and the generals gain fame, and many other profit financially, but you're doing the dirty work. One of your comrades says, "Wait a minute, where are you going?" And you say, "Leave me alone, I'll be back in a minute." Then you walk out into the woods of death, hunting for a piece of sausage. You can't see how anybody in civilian life has any kind of purpose at all. All their worries, all their desires, you can't comprehend it. More machine guns rattle. More parts of bodies hanging from wires. More pieces of arms and legs and skulls where butterflies perch on teeth. More hideous wounds, pus coming out of every pore. Lung wounds, wounds too big for the body, gas blowing cadavers, and dead bodies making retching noises. Death is everywhere. Nothing else is possible. Someone will kill you and use your dead body for target practice. Boots, too. They're your prized possession. But soon, they'll be on somebody else's feet. There's froggies coming through the trees. Merciless bastards. Your shells are running out. It's not fair to come at us again so soon, you say? One of your companions is laying in the dirt, and you want to take him to the field hospital. Someone else says, you might save yourself a trip. What do you mean? Turn him over. You'll see what I mean. You wait to hear the news. You don't understand why the war isn't over. The army is so strapped for replacement troops that they're drafting young boys who have little military use, but they're drafting them anyway because they're running out of men. Sickness and humiliation have broken your heart. You were betrayed by your parents, your schoolmasters, your ministers, and even your own government. The general with the slowly smoked cigar betrayed you too, turned you into a thug and a murderer. If you could, you'd put a bullet in his face. The commander as well. You fantasized that if you had the money, you'd put up a reward for any man who would take his life by any means necessary. And if he should lose his life by doing that, then let the money go to his heirs. The colonel, too, with his caviar and his coffee. He's another one. Spends all his time in the officer's brothel. You'd like to see him stone dead, too. More Tommies and Johnnies with their whack foamy daddy-o and their whiskey in the jars. You kill 20 of them and 20 more will spring up in their place. It just stinks in your nostrils. You've come to despise that old generation that sent you out into this madness, into this torture chamber. All around you, your comrades are dying, dying from abdominal wounds, double amputations, shattered hip bones. And you think, I'm only 20 years old, but I'm capable of killing anybody, even my father if he came at me. Yesterday, you tried to save a wounded messenger dog, and somebody shouted, don't be a fool. One froggy is laying gurgling at your feet. You stuck him with a dagger in his stomach, but the man still lives. You know you should finish the job, but you can't. You're on the real Iron Cross, and a Roman soldier's putting a sponge of vinegar to your lips. Months pass by. You go home on leave. You can't communicate with your father. He said you'd be a coward if you don't enlist. Your mother, too. On your way back out the door, she says, you be careful of those French girls now. More madness. You fight for a week or a month, and you gain 10 yards. And then the next month it gets taken back. All that culture from 1,000 years ago, that philosophy, that wisdom. Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, what happened to it? It should have prevented this. Your thoughts turn homeward, and once again you're a schoolboy walking through the tall poplar trees. It's a pleasant memory. More bombs dropping on you from blimps. You got to get it together now. You can't even look at anybody for fear of some miscalculable thing that might happen. The common grave. There are no other possibilities. Then you notice the cherry blossoms, and you see that nature is unaffected by all this. Poplar trees, the red butterflies, the fragile beauty of flowers, the sun. You see how nature is indifferent to it all. All the violence and suffering of mankind, nature doesn't even notice it. You're so alone. Then a piece of shrapnel hits the side of your head and you're dead. You've been ruled out, crossed out. You've been exterminated. I put this book down and closed it up. I never wanted to read another war novel again, and I never did. Charlie Poole from North Carolina had a song that connected to all this. It's called You Ain't Talking to Me, and the lyrics go like this. I saw a sign in the window walking uptown one day. Join the army, see the world is what it had to say. You'll see exciting places with a jolly crew. You'll meet interesting people and learn to kill them too. Oh, you ain't talking to me. You ain't talking to me. I may be crazy and all that, but I got good sense, you see. You ain't talking to me. You ain't talking to me. Killing with a gun don't sound like fun. You ain't talking to me. The Odyssey is a great book whose themes have worked its way into the ballads of a lot of songwriters. Homeward Bound, Green Green Grass of Home, Home on the Range, and my songs as well. The Odyssey is a strange, adventurous tale of a grown man trying to get home after fighting in a war. He's on that long journey home, and it's filled with traps and pitfalls. He's cursed to wander. He's always getting carried out to sea. Always having close calls. Huge chunks of boulders rock his boat. He angers people he shouldn't. There's troublemakers in his crew. Treachery. His men are turned into pigs, and then they're turned back into younger, more handsome men. He's always trying to rescue somebody. He's a traveling man, but he's making a lot of stops. He's stranded on a desert island. He finds deserted caves and he hides in them. He meets giants that say, I'll eat you last. And he escapes from giants. He's trying to get back home, but he's tossed and turned by the winds. Restless winds, chilly winds, unfriendly winds. He travels far, and then he gets blown back. He's always being warned of things to come, touching things he's told not to. There's two roads to take, and they're both bad, both hazardous. On one you could drown, and on the other you could starve. He goes into the narrow straits with foaming whirlpools that swallow him. Meets six-headed monsters with sharp fangs. Thunderbolts strike at him. Overhanging branches that he makes a leap to reach for to save himself from a raging river. Goddesses and gods protect him, but some others want to kill him. He changes identities. He's exhausted. He falls asleep and he's woken up by the sound of laughter. He tells his story to strangers. He's been gone 20 years. He was carried off somewhere and left there. Drugs have been dropped into his wine. It's been a hard road to travel. In a lot of ways, some of these same things have happened to you. You too have had drugs dropped into your wine. You too have shared a bed with the wrong woman. You too have been spellbound by magical voices, sweet voices with strange melodies. You too have come so far and have been so far blown back. And you've had close calls as well. You have angered people you should not have. And you too have rambled this country all around. And you've also felt that ill wind, the wind that blows you no good. And that's still not all of it. When he gets back home, things aren't any better. Scoundrels have moved in and are taking advantage of his wife's hospitality. And there's too many of them. And though he's greater than them all, and the best at everything, best carpenter, best hunter, best expert on animals, best seaman, his courage won't save him, but his trickery will. All these stragglers will have to pay for desecrating his palace. He'll disguise himself as a filthy beggar, and a lowly servant kicks him down the steps with arrogance and stupidity. The servant's arrogance revolts him, but he controls his anger. He's 1 against 100, but they'll all fall, even the strongest. He was nobody, and when it's all said and done, when he's home at last, he sits with his wife, and he tells her the stories. So what does it all mean? Myself and a lot of other songwriters have been influenced by these very same themes. And they can mean a lot of different things. If a song moves you, that's all that's important. I don't have to know what a song means. I've written all kinds of things into my songs, and I'm not going to worry about it, what it all means. When Melville put all his Old Testament biblical references, scientific theories, Protestant doctrines, and all that knowledge of the sea and sailing ships and whales into one story, I don't think he would have worried about it either, what it all means. John Donne as well, the poet priest who lived in the time of Shakespeare, wrote these words, the sestos and abidos of her breasts, not of two lovers, but two loves, the nests. I don't know what it means either, but it sounds good, and you want your songs to sound good. When Odysseus in the Odyssey visits the famed warrior Achilles in the underworld, Achilles, who traded a long life full of peace and contentment for a short one full of honor and glory, tells Odysseus, there was all a mistake. I just died, that's all. There was no honor, no immortality, and that if he could, he would choose to go back and be a lowly slave to a tenant farmer on earth rather than be what he is, a king in the land of the dead. That whatever his struggles of life were, they were preferable to being here in this dead place. And that's what songs are too. Our songs are alive in the land of the living, but songs are unlike literature. They're meant to be sung, not read. The words in Shakespeare's plays were meant to be acted on the stage, just as lyrics and songs are meant to be sung, not read on a page. And I hope some of you get the chance to listen to these lyrics the way they were intended to be heard, in concert or on record, or however people are listening to songs these days. I return once again to Homer, who says, sing in me, O muse, and through me
I'm
tell
the mother
the
of six children. Four ladies and two men. And this poem was for them. Admonitions. Boys.
Lucio Clifton.
I don't promise you nothing but this. What you pawn, I will redeem. What you steal, I will conceal. My private silence to your public guilt is all I got. Girls, first time a white man opens his fly like a good thing, we'll just laugh. Laugh real loud, my black women. Children, when they ask you, why is your mama so funny? Say, she is a poet. She don't have no sense. When they say it, it isn't funny. And they do.
Cruelty. Don't talk to me about cruelty or what I am capable of. When I wanted the roaches dead, I wanted them dead, and I killed them. I took a broom to their country and smashed and sliced without warning, without stopping, and I smiled all the time I was doing it. It was a holocaust of roaches, bodies, parts of bodies, red all over the ground. I didn't ask their names. They had no names worth knowing. Now I watch myself whenever I enter a room. I never know.
Yes, Lord, he was born with a withered arm. This is Lucy's child, Jeannie, my father's father. And when he was still just a baby, Lucy waited by the crossroad one night for Harvey Nichols to come to her. And when he rode up on a white horse, she cocked up a rifle she had stole and shot him off his horse and killed him, Lou. And she didn't run away. She didn't run away. She waited right there by the body with the rifle in her hand till the horse, coming back empty saddled to the stable, brought a mob to see what had become of Harvey Nichols. And when they got to the crossroad, they found Lucy standing there with the rifle in her hand. And they didn't lynch her, Lou, because she was Mammy Caroline's child and from Dahomey women. That's what I believe. Mammy Caroline got one of the lawyers' Sale family to defend her daughter because they was all lawyers and preachers in that family. They had a legal trial, and Lucy was found guilty and hanged. Mammy Caroline took the baby boy Jeannie and raised him and never let him forget who he was. I used to ask her sometime, Mammy, was you scared back then about Grandma Lucy? And she would look right at me and say, I'm scared for you, mister, that's all. She always called me mister. She said I was Mr. Sale. And Lou, I always was. Later, I would ask my father for proof. Where are the records, Daddy? I would ask. The time may not be right. It may just be a family legend or something. Somebody somewhere knows, he would say. And I would be dissatisfied and fuss with Fred, my husband, about fact and proof in history, until he told me one day not to worry, that even the lies are true. In history, even the lies are true. And there would be days when we young sales would be trying to dance and sing in the house, and Sammy, my brother, would miss a step and not be able to keep up to the music, and neither one of us could ever learn how to dance, and he would look over in the corner of the room and holler, "Damn, Harvey Nichols," and we would laugh.
Well, welcome back here to the Poetry Show. You've been listening to the Nobel Prize speech of Bob Dylan, accompanied on piano. And I've heard it now several times, and I can't fail to be moved by it. There's something about the there's a little bit of a masculine, I think, tone to the entire thing. He's talking about books in which there are very few female characters. The Odyssey, All Quiet on the Western Front, and Moby Dick. I suppose it might be interesting someone to observe and analyze that about, you know, some of Bob's stuff, but the depth of the readings and his Woody Guthrie-esque style of retelling those stories in ways that are somehow Bob Dylan and not just Herman Melville, Homer, and was it Lou Ayres? Lou Ayres, I think, is the name of the guy that wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. And it's interesting because it gives some insight into Dylan's anti-war stance, which has been pretty consistent, you know, throughout his career. He started out writing some of the most powerful songs against war that have been written in modern times, and with God on Our Side, but he'd written many. So I appreciate that that depth, because that comes through. Also, his anti-racist. I'm using political code words, but it's more than that. I mean, just listen to the description he has of Moby Dick and all the different kinds of people, and his fascination with that diversity and that complexity. And I think that comes out in his music as well, in many, many areas. I think it's a genuine and spontaneous interest that he has, too. I mean, I don't think it's all that composed or, studied. It's just him. And so it's great, that his inspired works of art have reached the Nobel Committee, and I think they were right. People sing Bob's songs all over the world, and they re-sing them, and they rediscover. I've rediscovered in the past couple of months tunes that he did that, in the middle of his career, a little bit later in his career, his voice went through, as we know, all kinds of stages, and apparently you can never completely quit smoking, and that, of course, will affect you in the long run, but still, even in his changed, and somewhat, now he's way over 70 now, your ability to sing sometimes is reduced to, a little bit like Leonard Cohen. You have to talk more, which is, I think I'm glad he took the time to do the Nobel lecture and to give it the attention that he obviously did and the thought that he obviously did. So, we're all going to benefit from that. He didn't have to sing it completely. And I'm not one of those who thought that. I always thought Bob's performances of his own material over the years were usually, not always, but usually the best performances. And, his voice is very interesting, but he's also capable of putting a song across in an unbelievably powerful way. I thank him for that. I added some Lucille Clifton. I had some recordings of her, and I just love her stuff. But we're going to move now a little bit to something slightly different here, okay, and that is a little discussion of the sonnet, And I have to, you know, I can't make up for Janet Harrison, who is still on sabbatical here on our program. I expect her to return someday, but she's got lots of stuff she's doing. She's putting a book out, actually. But anyway, the sonnet comes from the Italian word sonetto, which means a little sound or song. And the sonnet is a popular classical form that has compelled poets for centuries. Traditionally, the sonnet is a 14-line poem written in iambic pentameter. You know, da-dun, 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 da-dun. Five beats with, you know, sort of two half steps and for each beat. One, da two, da three, da four, da five. Like that. That's the iambic pentameter kind of rhythm. And the rhyme scheme of sonnets kind of varies somewhat depending on, you know, which generation of sonnet we're talking about. But they have several rhyme schemes that have evolved. But they generally, the sonnet adheres to a fairly tightly structured thematic organization. You're supposed to follow the rules or close to it. So we're going to read a couple here. For example, this is from Adrian Sue. The author of Living Quarters by Manic Depress, 2015. She teaches at Dickinson College and lives in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, not too far here from the Mustard Cafe. Okay. Anyway, this is called Four Sonnets About Food. And let me get the little thing over here so I can get this down. Words can't do what bird bones can. Stew to the stony essence of one small soul. The spent sacrifice boiled down to the hard white matter that nourishes the mighty predator who flourishes on the slaughtered animal and water. Who feeds another is like bones to him who eats. I say him only because it is a man in my house who eats and a woman who goes about the matter of sustenance. Food always being a matter of life and death, and each day's dining another small dying. Scallops seared in hot iron with grated ginger, rice wine, and a little oil of sesame, served with boiled jasmine rice, cures the malaise of long fluorescent weekdays spent in the city for money. And lastly here, I am afraid I can't always be here when you need a warm body or words. Someday I'll slip into the red clay I started with and forget who you are. But for now, here's my offering: baked red fish, clear soup, and bread. So anyway, there's a sonnet, but it follows none of the rules. I think it's great that we started out on one that ignores all the rules. Now we'll go back to a classic sonnet here for a second, called Sonnet Number 10. It didn't have a title. The first line of it is, "To one who has long in city pent." Okay. Sonnet. "To one who has been long in city pent." John Keats, 1795 to 1821, one of the most brilliant sonnet and ode writers, famous for Ode on a Grecian Urn and some other things, but short-lived, but a brilliant poet. Anyway, here's a sonnet number 10. "To one who has been long in city pent, 'tis very sweet to look into the fair and open face of heaven, and to breathe a prayer full in the smile of the blue firmament. Who is more happy when the heart's content Fatigued, he sinks into some pleasant lair of wavy grass and reads a debonair, gentle tale of love and languishment. Returning home at evening, with an ear catching the notes of Philomel, an eye watching the sailing cloudlet's bright career, he mourns that day so soon has glided by, even like the passage of an angel's tear that falls through the clear ether silently. All right, so you can see that, you know, just hanging out there in the grass can be an inspiration. I think the now that does follow a rhyme scheme: pent, firmament, content, languishment, right? I glided by, career, tear. Interesting, the very last line doesn't rhyme with anything. That falls through ether, clear ether silently. And then you have also a fair and prayer and hair and debonair and but the last one doesn't, because yes, returning home at evening with an ear catching the notes of Philomel and I. So he skips the rhyme there for the mix of ear and I, glided by and silently. Okay. So now we'll go back to a little bit of a more modern one here. This is called Plotted by Robert Lowell. And we'll see if this one follows the rules a little closer. Anyway, this is called Plotted. And Robert Lowell, 1917 to 1977, very well-known poet, you know, throughout the early part of the 20th century. And considered his collection of life studies, considered by many to have changed the landscape of modern poetry, sort of brought it out of the 19th century a bit. Anyway, this is a sonnet called Plotted. Planes are like arrows through the highest sky. Ducks V the ducklings across the puckered pond. Providence turns animals. Providence turns animals to things. I roam from bookstore to bookstore, borrowing and browsing books. I, too, maneuvered on a guiding string as I execute my written plot. I feel how Hamlet, stuck with the revenge play his father wrote him, went scatological under his clotted London sky. Cat-like on a paper parapet, he declaimed the words his prompter fed him. Knowing convention called him forth to murder, loss of free will and license of the stage, death's not an event in life, it's not lived through. Clever, very interesting poem. Robert Lowell. Anyway, I think we'll take a quick little break here, and then we'll move on to a more lyrical, slightly more lyrical poems from the Book of Love, or the Book of Hours, by Rainer Maria Rilke. And we're going to also do one other sonnet called Hecuba on the Shores of Danang by Deborah Paradis. But we'll be right back after we're going to do a little tune here. I was looking for the one I like the best. Here it is. Thank you.
run free, why not we? Across the swooping plain. My ears hear a symphony of two mules, trains, and rain. The best is always yet to come. That's what they explain to me. Just do your thing, you'll be king. And dogs run free. Free. Why not me? Across the swamp of time, my mind weaves a symphony and tapestry of rhyme. Oh, winds which rush my tail to thee, so it may flow and be. To each his own, it's all unknown. Dogs run free. If dogs run free, then what must be, must be, and that is all. True love can make a blade of grass stand up straight and tall in harmony with a cosmic sea. True love needs no company. It can cure the soul, it can make it whole. If dogs run free,
yes, well, welcome back here to the poetry show on enlightenedradio.org. I'll try to get these podcasts as soon as I can. It's going to be a little later today, though. I got a, kind of a busy morning here ahead of me. Anyway, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. Well, I wanted to read one more by Christina Rossetti here. Hold on a second here. Oh, and the one from Da Nang. I wanted to read that, too. Let's do that one first here. Now, this is a poet named Dorothy Paredes. I think that's how you Paredes you pronounce her name. She's the author of This Skin of Side of This Side of Skin from Wings Press in 2002, and this is called Hecuba on the Shores of Da Nang, of course, in Vietnam, 1965. Again, the sea machines creep from the east, their Cronus jaws unlatched and pups expelled. The scene the same, again and again, the sand now bootlace muck, the rutted shore resigned. No words will do. Laments will not withstand this thrashing tide. It's time for snarling beast speak, gnash rattle, fricka snap, unmuzzled hellhound chorus unbound from roughened tongues. Kinosima, keen, keen, lash, kakakakak, nine grind, then ground and rot and reek and teeth and grief and gabble ratchet growl. Custodian of woe, it doesn't end. Fleets on the reef, the horizon buckling. To meet what comes, the body cleaves from all that is human. I think we'll close on the sonnets with that here today. I think that poem speaks for itself, for those of you who remember anything about Vietnam. For those of you who don't, it's a good poem to read if you're thinking about adventures that lead you into the same place. It's my biggest grief of Veterans Day, you know, where soldiers who join the military and, well, sometimes for economic reasons, obviously. It's a professional army, after all. But otherwise, but generally to serve their country because, you know, you're told straight up you could risk your life in this enterprise. But the causes to which the leaders send these troops in, at least in recent decades, it's difficult to find one that is not poisoned by its corruptness or its ineffectiveness. I mean, the idea of going to war and that you cannot win or won't win or there's no way to win, unwinnable, or you don't know what you're doing. We have Iran before us, Iraq. Well, actually, we have Iran, too, because the whole thing with Iran, you know, evolved out of our interference in their country and replacing a democratically elected, democratically minded government with a dictatorship, a military dictatorship under the Shah of Iran. And the return of a royalty, basically, overthrown again by the finally by the Islamic religious leadership of the Shiites, Ayatollah Khomeini, and returned to a theocracy that, although they seem to be having some votes, but you know they still have a problem that the ultimate authority now lies with the religious leadership. Anyway, that's a failure. And Iraq, I mean, maybe what would have happened had we not invaded would have also been bad, but we wouldn't have lost 10,000 American lives. But I mean, it's been a disaster from beginning to end. Afghanistan. I don't think I need to explain that one to anybody or explain its unexplainability. It's what is the point and what is the objective and what can or has ever been achieved. I see no evidence myself, and I've been watching this for a long time, that it's any better than it was when it started. Okay, so we're going to pause for a minute, and we've got about 4 or 5 more poems here we're going to do from the Book of Hours and close for today on the Poetry Show. Coming up around noon today is going to be Fanny Crawford and her storytelling thing, although we're going to record it at 9:30 this morning, not at noon. But we'll do that and then schedule it so it plays at noon. That's about the usual time. In the meantime, let's return to Rainer Maria Rilke's Book of Hours, Love Poems to God. And we're going to read several of these as perhaps antidote to some of the things that are happening here. Where am I at here? I got this. There we go. Okay. All right. Now, none of these poems are titled by Rilke, and they're. But I think you'll get the idea. The hour is striking so close above me, so clear and sharp, that all my senses ring with it. I feel it now. There's a power in me to grasp and give shape to my world. I know that nothing has ever been real without my beholding it. All becoming has needed me. My looking ripens things, and they come toward me to meet and be met. And I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. And I circle around God, around the primordial tower. I have been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? I have many brothers in the South who move, handsome in their vestments, through cloister gardens. The Madonnas they make are so human, and I dream often of their Titians, where God becomes an ardent flame. But when I lean over the chasm of myself, it seems my God is dark and like a web, 100 roots silently drinking. This is the ferment I grow out of. More, I don't know, because my branches rest in deep silence, stirred only by the wind. And speaking of a letter to God, he says, we must not portray you in king's robes, you drifting mist that brought forth the morning. Once again, from the old paint boxes, we take the same gold for scepter and crown that has disguised you through the ages. And piously, we produce our images of you, till they stand around you like 1,000 walls, and when our hearts would simply open, our fervent hands hide you. And I love the dark hours of my being. My mind deepens into them, and there I can find in old letters the days of my life already lived and held like a legend and understood. And then the knowing comes. I can open to another life that's wide and timeless. So I am sometimes like a tree, rustling over the gravesite and making real the dream of the one its living roots embrace. A dream once lost among sorrows and song. And you, God, who live next door, if at times, through the long night, I trouble you with my urgent knocking, this is why. I hear you breathe so seldom. I know you're all alone in that room. If you should be thirsty, there's no one to get you a glass of water, and I wait, always listening. Just give me a sign. I'm right here. As it happens, the wall between us is very thin. Why wouldn't and why couldn't a cry from one of us break it down? It would crumble easily. It would barely make a sound. Some love poems to God to round out our poetry show for today, and I want to thank you guys for tuning in. In about an hour or so, about 10 o'clock, I think, we're going to be, we're going to be recording a storytelling show, and so it'll be live, actually, but we'll then replay it at noon. This morning. So that's kind of what's going to be happening next. And thank you for tuning into the Poetry Show. Take care of each other. It is late, but everything comes next.